From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Grand Rapids reckons with another lethal police shooting.
Every situation needs to be independently reviewed. There's a lot of questions that have not been answered.
Also, downriver perspectives on Detroit's growth.
Residents are looking for equity and they're looking for justice. They're trying to avoid having their home foreclosed upon.
And later, on It's Just Politics, the state budget director talks about the fiscal year ahead.
Governor Whitmer put out her eighth and final budget, and this budget continues to double down on the things that matter most to Michiganders. So the budget invests in kids at record levels, does what we can to lower costs for Michiganders, focuses on creating good-paying jobs and protecting access to health care.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the team from It's Just Politics has projections for the fiscal year ahead with State Budget Director Jen Flood.
We know that there's a deadline in state law that a budget should be presented to the governor by July 1st, and there are school districts, local communities, higher education institutions that rely on the state doing their jobs.
That's coming up on today's show, but first, the conversation we're about to have involves discussion of police use of force, violence, and death. Also, videos of a lethal incident. We just want you to take care of yourself and know that going in. Last Wednesday, a black man was shot by Grand Rapids police and died. Police say they were investigating a report that the man who was riding a bicycle was armed with a gun. According to a body-worn camera, the officer stopped DeQuayne Johnson, attempting to hold him to the ground. A canine dog is seen attacking Johnson while an officer is heard yelling, "Stop reaching, man, you're going to get shot." And moments later, the officer is heard firing. MLive reporter John Agar has been on the ground investigating what happened, and we've invited him to talk to us about what he's learned. John, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about DeQuayne Johnson and how police came in contact with him last week?
Well, there was a what they called an officer-initiated call that there was a felon out riding a bike who was armed with a gun. Either an officer saw it himself or a citizen had reported it to the officer. And then these two other officers, they came across DeQuayne Johnson. He was riding his bike. They tried to stop him where they used lights and sirens, but he just kept riding away. Police chief said it went on for a long time, several minutes, before they finally got him stopped in a parking lot of an apartment complex on the southeast side of town.
Right. Chief Eric Winstrom released three video clips from both the body-worn cams and a dash cam. On those videos, again, that were taken from the perspective of officers and their car, the police were following Johnson. And like you say, he rides out to the apartment complex. He hops off his bike. And from that point, things start happening very fast in the video. It seems like he slips and falls.
He slid on the ice and then he fell down. Then he was started to get back to his knees. And then the dog that had just been released was right on top of him.
Yeah. And about 20 seconds later, you hear shots in the video and you see his feet go limp. So, Chief Winstrom, what did he have to say about what happened, the events in his interpretation of these videos?
He just explained that the officers had been following him, that they gave him commands that weren't followed. They released the dog. And then at some point, at the end of the encounter, they shot him. It sounded like three shots were fired at him. He believed he'd been shot in his chest area or torso. And then he went to the hospital, underwent surgery for about 3 hours before he died.
Right. Now, DeQuayne Johnson's mother is Angelica Johnson. And she went on Facebook Live last Friday, a day after Chief Winstrom spoke to the public about this. What did Angelica Johnson have to say?
Well, she said right off the bat that her son was executed.
They executed my baby. They held his hands behind his back.
She had viewed the video that was shown, and then later she saw a video that was taken by citizens from somebody that lived in the apartment complex. She's convinced that her son is executed. She viewed his body last Friday and said that he'd been shot in the back of the head. That hadn't come up from police because the death certificate hasn't been filed yet.
In the video that she's talking about, this has been publicly shared by Kent County Commissioner Robert Womack. Whereas the police videos were POV from behind, were behind DeQuayne Johnson or kind of above him, this one that Commissioner Womack shared was recorded by a bystander standing off to the side. So it's more of the scene in profile. Now, I will say I could not see his arms. It does appear he has his shoulders lifted, but it was hard to tell. Like, was he rearing up or was he being dragged up and almost flipped over before the shots were fired? It's interesting that both videos involve some degree of narration. The body and dash cams that we have seen from the officers so far include them saying, you know, there's a gun and you know, talking about that. And the video that was released by Commissioner Womack also includes some narration from someone, I possibly him, saying, you can see his arms are behind his back. I almost feel like we're being encouraged to look at what happened in a couple of different ways as we look at these.
This happened in a parking lot below a 5-story apartment complex. So there were a lot of people that saw this. You either saw it or your next door neighbor saw it.
John Agar reports for M Live, and you can read his recent stories about the death of DeQuayne Johnson at mlive.com. John, thank you so much.
Oh, sure. Thanks.
We're talking today about an incident in which a Grand Rapids police officer shot resident DeQuayne Johnson to death 1 week ago. This incident took center stage at last night's city commission meeting. For hours, commissioners heard from residents who shared deeply personal accounts of their experiences with city police. Today, we're joined by Grand Rapids Second Ward City Commissioner Melinda Isasi to talk a little more about where things stand right now and what happens next. Commissioner Isasi, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Thanks for having me today.
How would you describe comment time last night?
You know, yesterday was the first city commission meeting that we've had since this officer-involved shooting where Mr. Johnson was shot and he was killed. The comments range from people that I've seen in commission chambers who, you know, had concerns and called for accountability in other officer-involved shootings. There was the mother of Mr. Johnson who came to ask questions and to really, I think it was a grieving mother is you know, what I heard and questions that she wants answered.
What price do we have to continue to pay until we get actual justice?
The videos that were released by Grand Rapids Police Department and those taken by bystanders appear to show some different takes on what happened. What did you and your colleagues take away from those variants in the narrative?
I really, you know, have said to myself and to my colleagues, every situation needs to be independently reviewed. There's a lot of questions that have not been answered. And while we know community is grieving, this mother is grieving, family is grieving, community is asking questions, and we need to ensure a fair and impartial outcome. And that's why the city of Grand Rapids works and has an independent investigation by the Michigan State Police, which is underway.
May I ask what questions are still in your mind about what actually happened?
I won't get into what the questions that I have at this time because I feel that that could potentially impact the investigation. In the meantime, one of the things that we did talk about that we could work on, the number of officer-involved shootings that we've had since 2022, how could it be a review of our public safety body? And how can we bring that call of what we're having for community? If we're doing this work, we're public officials, how do we share this and have full transparency and processes? And then, you know, last night at our city commission meeting, we heard from a few individuals. One individual stood out who talked about his experience with the Grand Rapids Police Department and one of the canines. And, you know, I think in full transparency, I have not fully reviewed our, you know, we have a policy around any of the deployment of a force that we would use, and we certainly have in that. But there were questions again from community. We said, this is something we'd like to look at. We'd like to understand this. And so how do we move forward with that?
Back in 2020, you were deeply involved in an effort by council to amend the budget, aiming to redirect a portion of police funding into community investments. It would have totaled less than 7% of the city's police budget. But ultimately, that amendment did not move forward. What I remember at the time is that there was a major concern about the treatment of Black residents by the police. There had been a moment in which two sixth grade boys were stopped and held at gunpoint because officers mistakenly believed that they were carrying guns and no guns were actually found at the scene. Do you see things having substantially changed since then?
Well, those were efforts, I think, at the time, really being led by community. And, you know, as a new commissioner, wondering what was happening, how do I make an impact? We had a different police chief at that time, a different set of circumstances. And as a city of Grand Rapids, since that time, there's been a number of things that we did. Again, prior to myself being on commission, we did have our youth interaction policy was absolutely important. Our city manager talked about that last night, having our foreign nationals policy and saying we will not cooperate with ICE. When you call the police department of the city of Grand Rapids, should not have fear if you need help that we're going to call and engage with immigration enforcement. Going forward and having our Office of Oversight and Public Accountability and having an alternative place to also be able to file a complaint should you believe one exists. Investing in our mental health co-response model, which has been significant. The number of people that were able to divert out of that direct police interaction, but being able to get really the mental health and response that we need, that was absolutely a call in 2020 from individuals in our community. So it's like, I think as a commissioner, a lot of times I sit with this both and is I've sat in meetings, I know what we've invested in, I have the budget, and then somebody's experience, they feel like it doesn't reflect that. And so I think our job is to be that bridge. And what does that mean for me as a commissioner? That means working with my colleagues, with the city manager, and also the police department, and especially community.
Melinda Isasi represents Grand Rapids' second ward as a city commissioner. Melinda, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, April.
Next up, one of the most interesting and diverse neighborhoods in Detroit and its role as a bridge between spaces and cultures. We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Many parts of Detroit can show you what it means to live in community, even when you don't have the access to resources that build infrastructure and institutions. Southwest Detroit has a particular knack for surviving and thriving. But that doesn't mean that neighbors here have been invited to fully participate in the city's renaissance. Nicole Trujillo-Pagan is an associate professor of sociology at Wayne State University. She also lectures on Latina, Latino, and Latin American studies. And she's just published a book called Detroit Never Left, Black Space, White Borders, and Latino Crossings, that draws attention to how race and space are not separate in Southwest Detroit and never have been. Nicole, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
You begin the book by inviting us to Southwest Detroit, which has been shaped, I think we can say, as much as any neighborhood and maybe more than most in the city by moneyed people who don't live there. And I mean, some people will be familiar with the most obvious example of this, the family of Matty Maroon, the late Matty Maroon, who was the owner of the Ambassador Bridge. It's now owned by his son, Matthew. And just the way the family, I guess, kind of used Southwest Detroit and, right. and Delray. And I want to talk about that. But before we do, you also introduce us in the early pages of the book to younger people who've had a very different experience of Southwest Detroit than like we may read about in the newspapers or we may have heard about. You talk about how their experience you know, offers a counter narrative. Can you give us an example of one way that that manifests?
Well, I'm not originally from Detroit. And so in the beginning of the book, I talk about my experience moving to Detroit and teaching at Wayne State University in the Center for Latino-Latin American Studies. I think it was pretty soon into my experience that, I'm teaching them sociology, and I'm teaching them about their neighborhood of concentrated disadvantage, and they, it's clearly flying right over their head. And so I'm trying to understand why it is that the lesson I'm trying to deliver is not being received. And, really, I think the book is the trip that I had to take, understanding my students so that I could understand the lives that they led. And it wasn't what I was trying to impose on them, which was an outsider perspective, as you suggest.
Yeah. You say that there are ways that property owners have tried to make Southwest Detroit seem a little more abstract than it is.
Right.
What do you mean?
Well, I think, this happens. This is not the only case in which this happens. And so I'm using Southwest Detroit to talk about more generally the relationship between race and space. And I think investors, often politicians, have a tendency to focus on property and property exchange, property transaction. And all of those are really disconnected from the experience of people who live in these spaces, who make these spaces, right? The ones who, for example, do public art or put up murals or who set up, a space out in front of their door to sell their wares. And that disconnection really undermined the life chances of people who live in Southwest Detroit. And I think that's the lesson I learned from first my students and then from the people I interviewed, that we had to sort of understand Southwest Detroit as part of something much larger, as part of Detroit, as part of the metro area. Mm-hmm. And now as clear in our national headlines, part of a international, right, struggle. And this is not just, with a lot of the Mexican origin immigrants who live in the area and immigration, but now also with Canada over the Gordian Bridge.
Yeah. The narratives as Detroit has gone through a period of investment and reinvestment have taken a lot of different forms over the past decade or so, but I was reminded as I was reading that there are some subtle things going on here, that when outsiders come to look at Detroit as a place for investment and try to make their case, they talk about it in terms of lack and things that have not, historically underperforming, historically undervalued and underperformed. And there is a difference between that and the way that people who live in the neighborhoods talk about lack of investment from their own perspective. Is there anything that you would want to draw our attention to what the difference is when folks who live in Southwest are talking about the lack of investments that they have experienced?
I really appreciate that. I feel like that's a really different angle than the way that I thought about it when I was writing the book. But absolutely, there is this sort of struggle between people who live in Southwest Detroit and in Detroit, the city, lacking resources, lacking investment, lacking viable work opportunities, right? The kinds of lack that investors are talking about. When investors talk about a lack, they frame it in terms of, this is why you need my money, this is why you need my investment, and I expect some, breaks, whether it be in terms of tax incentives, whether it be in terms of, property exchanges. And that's a very different type of lack than the one residents experience, right? Residents are looking for equity, and they're looking for justice. They're trying to avoid having their home foreclosed upon because, they were offered a mortgage at predatory interest rates, or because, they weren't able to access a property tax exemption, and now their home has gone into, tax foreclosure. So the lacks are really very different kinds of lacks. One is in terms of, you need something, and I'm sort of the hero who can bring it to you and you need to give me something in order to do that. And the other one is, you know, this is my neighborhood. This is my block. These are my neighbors that I have struggled with, not only as an individual, but as a family and for generations, right? Because I think something that a lot of people aren't sensitive to is that there are generations of Latinos in Southwest Detroit. In other words, they trace back their great-grandparents. The founding, really, of Southwest Detroit are still part of the legacy of families who live there today.
What were some of the threads that came up again and again in your research for, you know, among some of these families and their experiences of the neighborhood?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think because I'm a professor and because obviously I'm doing research. So my interviewees saw me as a professor who's doing academic work. Something I kept hearing, and I couldn't help but feel that they had already positioned me also as an outsider. They kept saying, you know, we don't all have to go to college. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that was a way for them to help me understand that opportunities in Southwest Detroit and in Detroit might not look like what I expected, but that doesn't mean that they didn't know how to make opportunities for themselves. Mm-hmm. Like I said, something that I don't see in many other cities, and I've lived in many cities in this country, is that on the weekend people do set out things, whether it be that they bought something wholesale, say, for example, dish soap, mm-hmm. and they're putting it out, or it's used clothes. And that's not something we see in many cities, but that kind of attitude, I'm going to figure out how to make it here because this is my, you know, this is my hill of beans. I'm going to make it work here, I think was something that was very surprising and very patterned across all of my interviewees. They had their presence in Southwest Detroit wasn't something that just happened. It was clear that they were making an intentional choice to stay.
Not all of Southwest Detroit stands in the shadow of our international crossing in the same way that, say, Del Rey does.
Right.
But it is really hard to talk about this part of Detroit without noting how it's an intersection that a lot of people pass through, and it's a place where business is at the heart of what goes on every day. Can you tell us a little bit about how you feel that that Southwest Detroit has been shaped by being a place where so many people beyond just the people who live in the neighborhood pass through every day?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to, I mean, you may look at, well, that's one of the things that I talk about in the book, right? That Southwest Detroit is treated as an abstraction. And I think most people who read my book will think about Southwest Detroit perhaps in terms of maps. And the unfortunate part is that you're going to miss that there's an important railway intermodal there. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of trains coming in at the same time that you have a lot of ships coming in with containers, right, crossing the Detroit River. There's a ferry that crosses it. And so if you're driving through Southwest Detroit, it's not only the international border. Right. There's the border that you talk about with Del Rey. So that's a highway. There is Michigan Avenue. And that's got to be what? I don't know. At least 8 lanes. You're going through many underpasses and overpasses that are designed to accommodate the railway, you know, the tracks. And so you really have this sense. And that's why, you know, the concept of borders became so important to the story. You have the sense, living in Southwest Detroit, that you're always crossing physical borders. There's these, the underpasses that only recently have been decorated, but mm-hmm. previously they felt like, you know, you sort of enter into this, space. And then there's, when it rains, it floods, and then there's potholes. It's almost like you don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, going through Southwest Detroit, that's really what a lot of residents experienced in the years leading up to foreclosure, right, because there were school closings. And then following the bankruptcy, there was a lot of uncertainty. And so I feel like the infrastructure of Southwest Detroit really mirrors the lived experience of a lot of residents, you know, not knowing, you have people, kids walking to school on the same streets as these, you know, tractor trailers. It's all kind of surreal.
When a community is based within what is a liminal space, are there ways that that shapes the community?
Absolutely. You know, when I first moved to Detroit to take this job, I moved to Southwest Detroit. I was on 25th Street, and I had two dogs, and I would walk them to Clark Park. And the southern border of Clark Park is the service road for I-75. And so if you're in Clark Park, certainly you're walking your dogs. You may be meeting with a friend, having a picnic. You know, there's a skating rink there. There's tennis courts. People play soccer frequently. And yet, at the southern border, it's perpetual traffic and horns and noise exhaust and, you know, dust from the cars. And so only recently have some trees been put up as, you know, the area prepares for the bridge extension, right, the Gordie Howe Bridge. But before then, you know, you have lots of accidents, lots of, you know, traffic that just kind of, it's always present in the background. And you're making a community at the same time that you feel that it's, I don't know, in some ways eroding at the margins of your community, you know, there's
or at least always trying to.
Yes, exactly. Like you feel this tension, this pull. Like it's never exactly the kind of idyllic birdies flying in the sky, peace and quiet that you would expect of a park.
A neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier Matthew Maroon, who is the owner of the corporation that owns the Ambassador Bridge. And this month, the rest of the world learned in great detail what I think a lot of people in Southwest Detroit have known for a long time, that the Maroon family will go to great lengths to try to protect its investment, including leveraging the attention of a president to try to influence what's going on in the neighborhood. And I wonder if any of that, I mean, I know it was not a huge surprise to people who lived in the area and a lot of other Detroiters, but was there anything that you observed of that interaction that was telling to you about just the way that Southwest Detroit is or is not valued?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I feel like, you know, Manny Maroon is an example, is like a archetype of what many people refer to as a speculator. Other people refer to as an investor, where they buy lots of properties in Southwest Detroit because they expect one day, right, that these properties will really appreciate in value. That's true for Manny Maroon. That's true. I mentioned Clark Park. The YMCA is a great example of it. I mentioned the train intermodal, the depot, right? The train depot was another example of it. You know, there's this sense that there's all of these companies, right? It may be held by one person, but they take on different names, different company names, so they can avoid a lot of regulations that city council would impose on the size of their business and their practices. And so then we realize that it's not just about one company. It's really about the ways that property is held by powerful groups who do have a lot of political connections, whether it be with city government, state government, or in terms of the influence they have with national leaders.
A system of extraction.
Exactly. That's exactly what I call it, system of extraction. I mean, I know that seems a strong word to use, but if you were in Clark Park, you know, the sort of image that I've created, and you look at the YMCA and how long it's been empty, you know, and how it's just such an eyesore, it just reminds you of the resources that kids in that area don't have. Right? Mm-hmm. So that someone can sit on that property, squat on that property legally. Mm-hmm. So the person who's poor can occupy a property without authorization and they're seen as a criminal. But someone can own the property and leave it empty, and that's fine with us.
You spend some time in the book talking about the Southwest Detroit's neighborhoods relationship with law enforcement and policing on several fronts. And, you know, immigration enforcement is not a new topic in Southwest, and it's not it seems, you know, it was evident from the book that it's not too far from people's minds, even though city policing is obviously, you know, maybe a little bit more of a presence in their lives day to day. What has been on your mind as the country has been going through this period of really aggressive immigration enforcement, sometimes in violation of U.S. law and practice, you know, people with green cards just sort of getting swept up if they, you know, don't have paperwork on them or something, given what people said to you in your research.
Yeah, I think it's really disappointing, you know, that you have really, I mean, from my perspective, I'm older now, but you have people who are in their 20s, you know, just starting out in life, having to sacrifice a lot of their freedoms for their family. So, for instance, they have to sacrifice being able to go to work or being able to go to school in order to take family members to a doctor's appointment or to the supermarket because those family members can't drive without fear of being stopped. And it's important, you know, that we understand that the city police could stop you for a traffic violation. And it has been true since I first moved to Detroit in 2006. I mean, they told me, yes, we call on immigration because they're right here, right? They're in the same area. So it's easy to call on immigration to help us translate. And so, you know, this is, you know, a surprise for someone who lives in the neighborhood, because why do we bring out the big gun so quickly, right? Why would we call on federal agents to translate when there are many community members who could do that? But it seemed an easy and frequent and common practice, at least according to them.
Yeah. Nicole Trujillo-Pagan's new book is Detroit Never Left. You can hear her talk more about it Saturday, April 18th at the Detroit Public Library's main branch. Nicole, thank you for the book, and thanks for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for talking to me about it. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
That wraps up Stateside for today. It's Just Politics is directly ahead. We will see you tomorrow.
From Michigan Public, this is It's Just Politics. I'm Zoe Clark.
And I'm Rick Pluta.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer delivers her State of the State address this evening. We'll speak with her budget director about what she wants to get done in her final year in office.
This is a more difficult budget than the others the governor has announced. We have a couple challenges facing our state.
But first, it appears a proof of citizenship and voter ID question is getting closer to the ballot in Michigan. The Americans for Citizen Voting Initiative would require Michiganders to show proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote.
You would also have to have a photo ID to have your ballot counted. Last week, we talked quickly about Americans for Citizen Voting, but we heard from so many of you wanting to know more that we are bringing in Haley Harding of VoteBeat to answer more of your questions. Haley, hi.
Hi, Haley.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first, just remind us, what would this ballot do? Because it is a lot.
Yeah, so this initiative is one of actually two relatively similar ones we've seen in Michigan that would functionally require state to verify the citizenship of every voter on the rolls. And if the state cannot independently verify it, it would require those voters to instead prove it to the state through whatever means they have to prove their identity. Usually that's a birth certificate would work just fine. It would also require anybody registering to vote in the state of Michigan to prove their citizenship at that time, which again is usually a birth certificate, a passport. There's a number of different ways you can do this.
And this is something that you currently don't have to do in Michigan.
Right. You do have to show documentation proving that you are who you say you are, or you have to sign an affidavit saying, I am this person. And I want to be clear that this affidavit is a legally binding document. You are signing it under the penalty of perjury. But there is also a federal requirement that when you register to vote, that you are a U.S. citizen. It is not something that a lot of people are signing up to vote on purpose if they are not citizens.
So why do proponents say this is needed?
People who are supporting this bill broadly say that any non-citizens at all, anyone casting a ballot who is not a U.S. citizen is too many, right? The idea is that this disenfranchises U.S. citizens by basically undercutting their ballot and having somebody else's ballot also count. Opponents, meanwhile, say that this is too broad a bill, requiring every single person to prove their citizenship, requiring the state to try to verify the citizenship of the 8 million people on Michigan's voter rolls. It's going to ultimately result, opponents of this proposal say, this is going to ultimately result in people being disenfranchised who are U.S. citizens but maybe don't have the documentation, or maybe, you know, the state just has a hard time verifying for whatever reason.
Are there examples of non-citizen voting changing the outcome of elections?
Not that I'm aware of, actually, anywhere in the United States. It's very, very important that people understand that non-citizen voting is extremely, extremely rare. In Michigan, we did an analysis, the state did an analysis last year, and found that over the course of several years, there was maybe 15, 16 people who were not citizens who voted in the election. And that is over the course of millions and millions of ballots cast. And these numbers are very, very similar to what we've seen in other states. It's usually about 15 to 20 non-citizens, maybe, have cast a ballot for 10 million people on the voting rolls per state. I can see where people come from when they say, you know, that's too many. That's too many. We can't have anyone who's not a citizen on the voting rolls. But I can also understand the argument of that's actually such a tiny, tiny percentage that it's possible that if we can go too far in disenfranchising people to ensure that those 10, 15, 20 people are not voting.
Well, Haley, let's talk about what opponents say, because what they argue is that this is about disenfranchisement. We've discussed the barriers, for example, one, proving citizenship.
Yeah, proving citizenship can be difficult if you don't have your documentation. If your name on your birth certificate does not match your legal name for whatever reason, maybe you got married, maybe you got married again, maybe you got divorced, maybe for whatever reason, your paper trail doesn't exist. Your house burned down. You lost your documents. From the numbers I've seen, somewhere between 9 and 15% of people are not able to just produce those documents on short notice. They might have to go get a new copy of it, or they might have to like spend the week tearing apart their house to try to find their birth certificate. It's not uncommon that people don't have these documents readily available.
Haley, what do we know about who this ballot question would affect the most?
The conversations I've had with people, opponents really truly believe that this is most likely to target married women, people who have changed their last names. That is probably one of the largest groups of people who have changed their names. I've also heard of it potentially affecting college students who may not have brought their birth certificate with them to college. You know, like I said, there's 10% of people probably at a bare minimum who cannot just produce these documents. And those are the people most likely to be hurt. People who maybe have moved, people who have faced evictions, people who just for whatever reason are struggling to get their documentation.
We're speaking with Haley Harding of VoteBeat, getting your questions answered about the Americans for Citizen Voting Initiative. Haley, who is behind this initiative and how much of the funding is coming from folks who are outside of Michigan?
So Americans for Citizens Voting specifically is funded by a group from Virginia, a libertarian group called the Liberty Initiative Fund. And that is funded by a man named Paul Jacob, who my understanding is he's a pretty wealthy guy. He and his group's goal is functionally to have proof of citizenship across the U.S. under this argument that any non-citizens voting are too many non-citizens voting.
So, Haley, you mentioned there is a second question in the field gathering signatures that also has to do with voter ID. Where does that stand?
Yeah, last time I talked to organizers for that one, and that one is more Michigan-based, right? That one originally, you might remember that Representative Brian Posthumus introduced a piece of legislation, a joint resolution, if you'll recall, that put these very similar parameters in place of you must have an ID, you must, you know, be able to prove your identity, the state should be able to prove it. If they can't, you will have to prove it yourself. New voters will have to prove their citizenship upon registration. That was introduced early last year. That did not make any progress in the House, did not move to the Senate, because obviously our legislature does have the option to put these constitutional amendments on the ballot. That did not get any traction there. Instead, this similar independent entity has started, has gotten approval to gather signatures. Last I talked to organizers there, they hadn't been doing it yet, but they are, you know, in that time frame right now where if they want to be gathering signatures, they got to start soon.
Haley, in the final minute that we have you, back to the Americans for Citizen Voting question. What comes next in the process of whether it will be before voters on their November ballots?
Yeah, the next step for them, my understanding is that the organizers for Americans for Citizen Voting are still gathering back all of the signature petition sheets that they have. Those will have to go to the Bureau of Elections at the state level. Employees there will verify those signatures, make sure that they are of valid Michigan voters, right? They will go through and ensure that the number of signatures. It's about 450,000 signatures across the state. They will verify that that is correct. If that is correct, and if those signatures are valid, you will very likely see that on the ballot this November.
That is Vote Beats Haley Harding. Thank you for answering so many of the questions we got from so many of you who emailed in. Haley will be in touch.
Thanks, Haley.
Thank you guys so much.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer is set to deliver her eighth and final State of the State address this evening. She'll set out her priorities for her final year in office.
But we already have some ideas about what she wants to do. Jen Flood, Whitmer's budget director, outlined the governor's budget recommendations earlier this month in Lansing.
Jen Flood, welcome back to It's Just Politics.
Hi, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jen, this is an $88 billion budget, hard to call it an austerity budget by any means. But our understanding is the state will most likely take in less money this year. So what's the plan to balance this budget, which the state has to do constitutionally?
Governor Whitmer put out her eighth and final budget, and this budget continues to double down on the things that matter most to Michiganders. So the budget invests in kids at record levels, does what we can to lower costs for Michiganders, focuses on creating good paying jobs and protecting access to healthcare. This is a more difficult budget than the others the governor has announced. We have a couple challenges facing our state. Number one, rising healthcare costs. We know Michiganders across the state, small businesses are facing the skyrocketing increase of healthcare, and that impacts our state budget as well. This is happening at the same time that the federal government is handing the tab to states across the country on really important programs like Medicaid and SNAP benefits. Finally, we're on the hook for implementing some of the changes that Congress passed last year when it relates to Medicaid. So there are new work requirements which are intended to kick Michiganders off Medicaid. And we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that the 2.5 million Michiganders who rely on Medicaid for access to healthcare maintain that coverage. So getting fewer resources from Washington, D.C., there's a lot of economic uncertainty when it comes to trade and tariff policy. But we can do hard things. And so the governor put out her balanced budget proposal. We're going to work with Republicans and Democrats in the legislature to get it done.
So with all of that said, what do you say to those who bring up the fact that the state budget, when the governor's first term budget was $64 billion, and this year it's more than $20 billion bigger? What do you say?
There's a lot of things that go into the math here, but I'll say this. When you adjust for inflation, our general fund budget is about 4% bigger than it was when the governor took office. At the same time, with the smaller increase adjusted for inflation, we've stood up some incredible programs. We now have universal pre-K for every four-year-old in the state of Michigan. And when they graduate from high school, they can get a community college degree at no cost. They also get more than $27,000 towards a four-year degree. We have doubled the reserves since the governor took office with a record balance in the rainy day fund. We've had our credit rating upgraded. We paid off more than $28 billion in debt.
Speaking of the rainy day fund, one part of this proposal takes money from that budget stabilization fund, that's its official name, basically the state's savings account. Why do you think that it is fiscally prudent to do that right now?
The governor has built up record reserves since she took office. If you look back 20 years ago, we had $2.2 million in reserves. And today we've got north of $3 billion. And so due to the governor's sound fiscal management over her first 7 years in office, we've built up a record balance in those reserves. As I mentioned, we're facing some unique challenges in this moment. We've got increased healthcare costs. We've got the federal government passing the buck to us. And we've got some really important work to do to make sure that people maintain access to healthcare and that we're administering SNAP benefits, which keeps grocery bills down for Michiganders. So When we approach this final budget, we're facing a $1.8 billion gap. And to bridge that gap, the governor's proposing a responsible mix of revenue, reductions in efficiencies, and drawing from reserves. So our state's economists come together twice a year to sort of give us the outlook on the economy and let us know what revenues are available to get the budget done. Those economists a couple weeks ago came together and calculated a withdrawal of north of $500 million from our reserves to help us weather this next budget year. We're taking less than was calculated, and we'll still leave a record balance in our reserves, more than double when the governor took office.
We know that one of the proposals in order to find more money for this budget to make up that $1.8 billion is an increase on so-called vice taxes, right? This includes things like new taxes on vaping. But Republican House Speaker Matt Hall has already basically said no to any new taxes. How is that going to work with your budget recommendation that relies on some amount of increase in revenue?
What the governor put out makes sure that we focus on what matters most, that we're continuing to invest in our kids, that we're continuing to protect access to healthcare. We have the tools that we need to compete for jobs. This is a start in a negotiation. We feel like we put out a really solid plan. And I know that in the weeks and months ahead, the Senate will put out their proposed budget and move that in May. We're expecting the House will put out their plan as well, and we'll get together later this year, set our differences aside, because I know at the end of the day, we care about the same things, and that's making sure that Michigan is successful and we're set up for long-term stability, and we'll get something done. The governor's got a track record of 7 bipartisan budgets, and we'll pull together Republicans and Democrats and work out a plan again later this year.
There is this outstanding issue of the new wholesale marijuana tax that could cut an additional $420 million out of the state's revenue picture if it's deemed unconstitutional in the courts. How do you plan for that?
We feel strongly that the roads package that was passed last year was a huge bipartisan success. Legislators and governors have been trying to make sure that every penny paid at the pump goes to the roads for decades. And we were able to bring together Democrats and Republicans and get it done. We passed a $2 billion bipartisan roads deal that's going to fix roads and bridges owned by the state and in local neighborhoods across the state. We feel great about the plan. We are watching what happens in the courts, but at the end of the day, we're focused on fixing the damn roads, and we know we'll get it done.
Jen, I'm thinking about the fact that this is the governor's last budget. How did that figure into deciding what should and shouldn't be in this plan? I guess I'm thinking about legacy building.
That's the governor's final proposed budget sets Michigan up for long-term success. We have had incredible partnership with both Democrats and Republicans in the legislature over the past 7 years. This budget makes sure that the programs we've stood up, like universal pre-K, free school meals, our scholarship programs, are on solid footing so that they last long into the future after the governor's term has ended.
Although last year, of course, we saw maelstrom with the budget getting done not in time for the constitutional deadline. How's your feeling about working with Republicans this year to get a budget done, I'm going to say by October 1st, let alone the statutory deadline of July 1?
The governor met her statutory deadline of presenting a balanced budget a couple weeks ago. I'm expecting the Senate to follow a traditional timeline and move their budgets in the weeks and months ahead. And I'm hopeful the House follows that same timeline. We know that there's a deadline in state law that a budget should be presented to the governor by July 1st. And there are school districts, local communities, higher education institutions that rely on the state doing their job. So I am hopeful and optimistic that we'll get things done this June.
That is Jen Flood. She is Governor Gretchen Whitmer's budget director. Jen, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm. And you can hear live special coverage of Governor Whitmer's final State of the State address right here on Michigan Public. Rick and I, we're hosting it beginning tonight at 7. And that is It's Just Politics for today. I am Zoe Clark.
And I'm Rick Pluta.
Let's talk again next week.